I. What I'm going to do tonight is show you some slides that will talk about osteoporosis. It'll talk about what it is, how common it is, how you can reduce your risks of developing it, and basically look after your bones to keep them as strong as possible. If you have any questions at any time, feel free to stop me. If I start speaking too quickly, feel free to stop me and tell me as well, because sometimes I just start rushing. So what I'm going to do is start off by asking you a question which you probably know the answer to, but does anybody know what osteoporosis is? Yeah, you want to tell me? Weak bones, yeah. Brittle bones, yeah. Okay, that's about right. Most people, you hear them describe it as weak bones, thin bones, soft bones, brittle bones. So anything like that to describe really the fact that your bones are weaker than they should be and they're going to break easily. Now, what you've got here is a formal definition, and it basically says that. It's mentioning that your bones are really, the two aspects to your bones are bone quality and bone density. Quality you can't do anything about because that's really just what you're born with, basically. You might have really good, strong quality bones, but the density you can do something about to a certain extent. So what we have here, you've got two pictures. The first one here is normal bone, and the second one is osteoporotic bone. Now you can see with the normal bone that basically, this is obviously the insides of it, it's quite dense and like a honeycomb, okay? Small holes, very solid. And the osteoporotic bone has bigger gaps or bigger holes in it and thinner bridges. And the two yellow arrows actually point to a break in there. So if you think of your bones, if they're like this on the inside, the normal bone, I always think in terms of your wrist or something. If you knock your wrist or something, if it's nice and solid like that, it might hurt, but your bones should be fine. If your bones are like the osteoporotic ones, it won't take much of a trip or a knock to actually break them. Okay? Osteoporosis is called the silent thief, and that is basically because you don't feel osteoporosis developing, and most people don't know they've got it until they actually break a bone. So it can be developing over many, many years, and you don't know about it until you actually fracture or break a bone. And by the way, a fracture and a break are the same thing. You don't feel it in a way. Sometimes people will come and say that, you know, their arms ache or their legs ache, and it's their osteoporosis. Well, that's not really going to be it. The pain that you do get with it, the only pain really comes from the fractures. Otherwise, you're not going to feel, as I say, feel it developing. If you say you're feeling pain, quite often people will confuse it with arthritis. A very basic difference between arthritis and osteoporosis is your bones and you don't feel pain unless you break it. Arthritis is your joints and you do feel pain, and also arthritis is much more visible. Generally, osteoporosis is not visible. I'll show you in a few minutes that in some cases it is, but generally it's not visible. Arthritis generally tends to be rather more visible than that. So these are the most common fractures that you get with osteoporosis. We call them low trauma fractures or fragility fractures. And what happens is you get these breaks usually from something as simple as a fall from standing height or lower. So if you fall out of the chair, or if I was walking across the floor here and I tripped and fell, I should be able to get back up and be okay. Maybe a little bit shaken, but I shouldn't have any broken bones. If from a simple fall like that I've broken bones, then that should raise a red flag, because that's not normal. So the most common ones, wrist, spine, and hip. Now the wrist is by far the most common. Once you've had one fracture, and it'll quite often will be the wrist first, or some other one, but not usually the spine and hip first, but that is actually predicted that you're gonna have fractures in future. So once you've had a fracture, you actually increase the likelihood that you're gonna have a future fracture. If you have osteoporosis, or if you've had a fracture, it's not too late to actually take steps to reduce the risk of the disease getting worse and actually getting more fractures in the future. Quite often we'll get people who talk to us and say, well, it's too late talking to me because I've already got osteoporosis or I've already broken bones. Well, that's not the case, because there's still a chance that you will have, you know, you could have fractures in the future. So what you want to do is reduce the risk of that happening. So this is how common it is. 1 in 4 women and 1 in 8 men, or at least 1 in 8 men in Canada, has osteoporosis. So the surprising thing about that is a lot of people I'm going to say that you're probably the exception. Most people think that men don't get osteoporosis. We're only now just sort of getting to the stage where quite often in sort of, if we're in health fairs or health events, men will actually take information about osteoporosis. And we actually developed a fact sheet called Men and Osteoporosis so we can say, this is specifically for you. Quite often they'd sort of veer clear of any of our information, but now we can say, you can take this one piece that refers specifically to you. Now these figures are actually quite old figures, because in Canada they haven't collected the stats on osteoporosis nationally since the early 90s. So I think these are from about 1993. If we go with international figures and assume that Canada is probably similar to the international figures, it's probably more like 1 in 2 or 1 in 3 women and 1 in 5 men. So what you're seeing is an increased rate of osteoporosis, and that means there's going to be an increased risk of fracture. So this is a bit of a concern, because as well as that increased rate, or that probable increased rate, we're also getting an aging population. So a lot of the Canadian population is moving up into the 50-plus age group, which is the age around which you start to see osteoporosis appear more frequently. And what that means, again, is there's going to be an increase in fractures, and particularly hip fractures, which are probably around the most debilitating ones that you can get. So about 2 million Canadians are affected by osteoporosis overall. And again, the concern is with the aging population and the increase in hip fractures that we're likely to see. So I'll give you a bit of information on this. This is looking at spinal fractures, and then I'll give you some information on hip fractures. It's not exactly cheerful information, but it's sort of information that's useful to know. And then I'll move on to more sort of optimistic stuff, but we'll get through this right now. What I've also got in here, tends to be the similar to the general presentations that we give to a lot of groups, but what we have in here is inserted some slides specifically about how osteoporosis affects men in particular. So you'll see that information come up every so often. So this figure on the left has a normal spine. That means that person has not had spinal fractures, okay? So you can see the tallest figure there, because one indicator of spinal fractures is height loss, okay? One way that you can check your spine, because spinal fractures can actually be quite difficult to diagnose. They can have pain, varying degrees of pain, or there might not be that much pain at all. And they're not, if you go, say, to the doctor or to the emergency with back pain, you might be treated for the pain, but it might not be recognized that the cause of the pain is an osteoporotic fracture. So it's a bit of a difficult one to diagnose at times, and quite often goes undiagnosed. But this person has a normal spine, and a couple of ways that you can check your spine other than through whether there's any pain. You take three finger breaths, so that's what the 3 FBs are on there, and you put them there and up. So this is going between your rib cage and your hip bone. You should be able to fit 3 fingers. There should be space there to do that, okay? If you can fit the 3 finger breaths, or if you've got the 3 finger breaths between the rib cage and the hip bone, it's a sign that your spine is normal. Another one is that if you stand against a wall, so if you're standing straight against a wall, you should have about 4 centimeters between the back of your head and the wall, because you're not going to stand with your head tilted back. When you stand straight, there will be naturally that small space between the back of your head and the wall. So that's normal spine. The person in the middle has had spinal fractures. And what happens there when you have the spinal fractures is your spine starts to collapse and you start to lean over. And this is where you see one of the visible signs of osteoporosis. I think traditionally people's image of somebody with osteoporosis is usually an old woman or an older woman who's stooped, who has an arched back, and that's basically kyphosis, which is what I'm describing now. One of the few visible signs, apart from fractures or broken arms, of osteoporosis. Now what's happened with the person in the middle, so the spine's starting to collapse, they're starting to lean forward because of the spine collapsing. And that means that basically, as you can see there, as they lean forward, the rib cage, everything, the body starts to lean over. You can only fit 2 fingers between the rib cage and the hip bone now. So there's less space there. And if you try to stand straight up against the wall, you can't straighten up properly. So there's going to be a bigger gap between the back of your head and the wall. So we say about 8 centimeters there. The third figure's had multiple fractures. And what you can see, is that the rib cage is actually almost sitting on the hip bone there. And that's where you're going to get pain. because you've got those bones rubbing against each other. So that's the permanent state for that person. So there's no, they definitely can't fit any finger breadths, there's no finger breadths there. You've got the pain that goes with that. You've got this pain of the spinal fractures. The person is, again, much more stooped, and there's going to be a bigger gap between the back of the head and the wall. And you see a protruding stomach as well. Now, quite often when people are in reach that stage, they think that they put on weight. But what it really is when you think about it, if your body is permanently leaning over, you've got all your internal organs getting squashed. They basically have to find somewhere to go, so they push out. So it's not necessarily a weight increase, it's just your internal organs trying to find a weight, a space, really. So what you get along with this, with the back pain and the pain with the hip and the rib cage there, there's breathing difficulties, digestive difficulties, a lot of things like, so it's a very, very uncomfortable and debilitating condition. So again, you know, talking to people about just looking after the bones and getting the calcium and vitamin D sounds quite often like a light message. But what we try to say to people is that if you don't do that, and if you're not doing that throughout your life, that's the kind of stage that you can get to. And that's what we want to actually prevent you from getting to. Is this okay? Has anybody got any questions? Is it clear? Okay. So going on to hip fractures, I say we'll move over to something a bit more cheerful now. We have to get sort of hit you with the bad news first. Hip fractures are about 25,000 a year in Canada. We say here there's about 70% are osteoporosis related. It can actually go up to around 90%. You can tend to assume most hip fractures are related to osteoporosis or caused by osteoporosis. Probably the surprising news is that with the hip fractures, one in four people will die within a year of complications. So maybe something like pneumonia or infection, something like that. But one in four will die within a year. One will recover to the previous level of fitness, and two will need assisted living. So that's a very, you know, I mean, that really is a stage we don't want people to get to. So again, it doesn't matter if you do develop the disease, it doesn't matter if you have fractures, it's never too late to actually take steps to avoid the next fracture or reduce the risk of the next fracture. And the other thing, around 30% actually of hip fractures occur in men. So what you're looking at there is a higher rate of hip fractures in men. I think with women it's around, I think it's about 17% or 20%. So there's a higher rate in men. Let me just go here. Yeah. So men overall sustain fewer fractures. The mortality associated with hip and vertebral fractures is higher with men. And usually this will be because they might be older when they start a fracture or they might be more frail. But generally, one in three men, so the figure I said before, about one in four people will die of a hip fracture. Within men specifically, the group of men specifically, it's going to be one in three, which means they've got a higher rate of mortality. So again, 1 year post-hip fracture mortality, 31%, 17% for women. So that's information on the impact on the individual, so how severe the disease can actually be. The flip side to that is looking at the cost to the healthcare system. So you've got the cost to the individual and the families, and then you've got the cost to the healthcare system. Figure 1.3 billion is actually another old one from about 93 or 97, I think. It's around 2 billion a year at the moment is the cost. And most of those costs really are around people who have the hip fractures, so really trying to deal with them and get them the assistance and the rehabilitation that they need. And again, the aging population and the anticipated increase means around 2018, they're expecting it to be $32.5 billion. So this is why you have people like me coming out doing presentations about osteoporosis, to try and help people understand it and try to get them to reduce the risks of developing it and getting to the fractures, because it makes much more sense to put the money up front as an investment to help people sort of really manage their lifestyles in a way that's going to reduce the risks and also save the cost of the healthcare system overall. I'm going to run this one back. So, there's a question coming up for you. Your bones are living tissue, and they're constantly developing. And what happens is you constantly lose an old bone and build a new bone. Now, there's an age at which your bones are the best that they're going to be, well, what we call peak bone mass, the strongest they're going to be at some point in your life. And I'm wondering if anyone wants to take a guess at what age that might be. 21. Sorry? 21 was that? 35? 30? Ah. So in females, it's around 16, and males around 20. And the reason for this, it's basically it's linked to your growth. So in childhood and adolescence, there's this continuous growth going on. Your bones are growing and getting bigger. And what's happening is you're building a lot of new bone. So they're getting bigger and stronger, and you're losing a small amount of old bone. So that process of losing old bone and building new bone goes on throughout your life. But in childhood and adolescence, you've got this real build-up of new, strong bone going on. And this is why the messaging is important in childhood, and sort of directing that message at parents to make sure the children get the calcium, the vitamin D, and physical activity. So they build the bones up to be as strong as possible by this age, because when they get to that age, that's the best their bones are going to be at any point in their life. So you want to get them as strong as possible to serve them really for the rest of their life. Because what happens after these ages and they stop growing is they start to lose old bone at the same rate as building new bone. So it kind of equalizes. And then what happens when you get to about your late 30s, around early 40s, you start to actually lose bone faster than you build new bone. So there is generally, as you go throughout your life, you do start to, your bones do start to get weaker. That's not osteoporosis, that's normal bone development. Osteoporosis will be much more severe, sometimes a bit more rapid, depending on the situation. But basically, your bones will get weaker as you get older. So you want to build them up to that really strong point as far as possible to help sustain you as well as possible throughout your life. This diagram basically describes it, and you can see the bottom line is the women's one, and you can see that sort of build up in both of them there, the fast building in the strength and mass of the bone. And then when it equalizes, when you're losing bone at the same rate as building new bone, and then it starts to drop. So the gray area there, the increased risk area for women is after menopause, and that's because of the hormonal changes. At that point, women can lose up to 5% of their bone mass a year. So the message again of calcium, vitamin D, and physical activity throughout your life continues. Whether you develop the disease, whether you don't develop the disease, whatever age you are, you have to get your calcium and vitamin D, but that's a time of higher risk when you have to be particularly attentive. Now with men, it's a similar process, but it's much slower, much more gradual. So men are going to be building much stronger bones and really getting a higher peak bone mass. And the progress in bone development there is tends to be a bit slower with men. They do eventually start coming down, but as you can see, it's a different state to women. So again, you get to 30 and 40 when the bone replacement and bone building equalizes, you can actually lose between 0.5% and 1% of your bone mass a year. With women, it goes up to about 5% post-menopause, and with men, it's slower, but higher after 65, and that's what the diagram is sort of showing. So the differences for men, if we go back to the diagram quickly, so you see the difference there. It's much more sort of smooth and uniform than the what goes on with the women there. Difference with men, first of all, is that they do get higher peak bone mass because they're physically usually bigger and stronger than females. So just generally speaking, this will be one explanation for why men don't get osteoporosis as often as women or at the same rate as women. Greater bone size, greater bone mass. Gradual andropause, as opposed to the way women are basically hit much more directly in a shorter space of time by menopause, tend to be physically more active, lower incidence of falls, and men generally have a shorter life, so there are less cases of osteoporosis and fractures amongst men, which might seem like a bit of an odd thing to say, but it is the case. Okay, so we've moved on from the depressing side of it. We're going to go on to the more positive stuff now. Factors that affect bone health. So there's about four main groups here. The first two, genetics and hormones. There's not so much you can do about those. Maybe a little bit, but generally it's just what you landed with life. The second two, nutrition and physical activity, you can do something about. We call them modifiable risk factors. So the genetics is basically, your bones are similar to those of your family members. They might not be exactly the same, and in some cases they might be quite different, but generally speaking, your bones are similar to those of your family members. This means that if somebody in your family has osteoporosis, or if they've had fractures, osteoporotic fractures, especially hip fractures, that puts you at higher risk of developing the disease. So that's one way that people can find out about it as well, is, you know, rather than finding out they have a fraction and you find out they might have osteoporosis or risk factors for osteoporosis. If you know it's in the family, there's a greater chance that you're going to have some information about it and know that you're at risk, and then you can take steps to reduce your risk of developing the disease. Hormones, as I mentioned before, so testosterone, estrogen, progesterone, dropping those levels means that it's basically going to affect your bone density. And this is particularly relevant, obviously, in some of the treatments, the cancer treatments as well, which would be applicable here. What I have here, I've got some fact sheets on here, including one called secondary osteoporosis, and that talks about different medications and different conditions that can affect your bone health. And there are several references in there to prostate cancer that you might find interesting. You probably already know about it, but generally it's amongst that information that can go out and tends to raise quite a lot of awareness with people, because when you're given medications, you might not always know what the likely side effects are of them until they actually develop. So feel free to take these at the end. You might find that one quite an interesting read. Okay, so that was, what was that? Genetics and hormones. So now I'm going to go into nutrition. So the same message, I will give you the same message that you would get from someone from the Diabetes Association, Heart and Stroke, Cancer Society, and that is that you should get a good have a good healthy diet and stay physically active, because they're the important elements of general overall health maintenance and disease reduction, or disease risk reduction, okay? Within your healthy diet for your bones and to help reduce the risk of osteoporosis, what you're looking for is making sure you get enough calcium and vitamin D in your diet. And this is the amount that you're looking at. So we actually, I think it was about 3-4 weeks ago, we launched new clinical practice guidelines. So a lot of our information was updated. And one of the updates was the fact that age over 50 now, you just need 1,200 milligrams of calcium a day. Previously it was 1,500. So 1,200 milligrams a day, what we suggest is that you actually get your calcium through your diet, okay? The reason you need to get 1,200 milligrams is because that will help you meet your body's needs. Most of your body needs calcium, but only one place stores calcium, and that's your bones. So if you're not feeding your body the amount of calcium that it needs each day, what's going to happen is the cells in your body will start to look around and say, where can we get the calcium we need? And what they'll do is they'll go to your bones and take it from your bones, and that will weaken your bones. So to make sure that your body gets what it needs, you give them the 1,200 milligrams a day, your body's satisfied, all aspects of your body getting the calcium that they need. So we want you to get it through your diet. One of the unfortunate things right now is that we don't have our calcium fact sheet available because it's being updated. But I do have calcium counter cards, and they're on the table as well. And what this does is remind you how much calcium and vitamin D you need each day, and it's a small table. It's the same for men and women, and it just goes according to age, okay? On the other side of it is a small food table, and that gives you an idea of how much calcium is in different foods. So what you can do is monitor your diet over maybe about five or six days or a week to get a sense of how much calcium's in your diet. And you'll probably, you know, you might be surprised to see how much is in there, because there's calcium in foods, in some foods in all the food groups. So you'll start with the main ones, which is going to be your dairy products, because that has the highest amount of calcium and the most easily absorbed. So you're looking at milk, yogurt, cheese, etc. And there's a lot in there. In a glass of milk, you're going to get about 300 milligrams of calcium. So if you need 1,200 a day, just a couple of glasses of milk is going to get you well on your way towards that, what you need. Things like tinned sardines and salmon have calcium in them, but you have to get the stuff with the bones in it and make sure that you eat the bones. I notice now you can get tinned salmon without the bones, which is probably very nice if you like salmon, but it's no good without the bones because the calcium's in the bones. I've actually met one woman once as well who used to like it with the bones, but she'd take the bones out and eat the bones and leave the salmon. And I've never come across anybody else since then who's actually done that, but usually people do tend to pick the bones out of it, I think. Also, things like bread have calcium added to them, and muffins in small amounts, but still it helps add up to the contribution or the need that you have each day for the actual amount of calcium. Leafy green vegetables like kale, bok choy, broccoli, that has calcium in it, but you have to cook the broccoli. So it's good for you raw, but you won't get much calcium out of it. You have to actually cook it to get the calcium out of it. A medium-sized orange has about 50 milligrams of calcium in it. You can also get fortified orange juices and apple juices as well, I've seen. The fortified orange juices actually have as much calcium in a glass of that orange juice that equals the same the amount of calcium that you get in a glass equal-sized glass of milk. So there's some good options there. Soya products as well. They're fortified, a lot of those are fortified with calcium. It's not as easily absorbed, it's not quite as much, but it's still a good source. So there is quite a range there. I would suggest, what I can do is send you some of the calcium fact sheets when they're done, because it's got a good food table, which would help guide you through basically just assessing how much calcium you're getting in your diet each day. What you can do when you've calculated it is see, is it coming up to the 1200? And if it isn't, can you adjust your diet? If for some reason you can't adjust your diet or there are certain foods you can't tolerate and you find it hard to get to the 1,200 milligrams, you can top it up with supplements. So if you find you're only getting about 800 milligrams in your diet, maybe take one supplement to top it up to the 1,200. But try to get as much of it, if not all of it, through your diet. Going on to supplements, you're probably going far, you've seen in the pharmacist, there's like wall-to-wall supplements for everything, including calcium. You'd probably best to talk to a pharmacist to basically start you off to see what might be the best option for you, because there's calcium chews, there's tablets, there's liquid, many different brands. So you start with the pharmacist, see if the pharmacist will suggest one for you, and just go from there. If you don't like it, then come back and try a different one. There are two different main types, calcium carbonate, calcium citrate. Calcium carbonate is the most common, you take that with food. Citrate you don't have to take with food, but there's less calcium. You have to take more tablets and they're more expensive. So there's a lot of things to weigh up there. One other thing you have to bear in mind is do not take your calcium all at once. So don't think you can take your calcium in the morning and you're done for the day. 1,200 milligrams of calcium, your body will only process 500 and the rest you'll lose through urine. So your body can only process up to 500 milligrams at a time, so you need to spread it out throughout the day. And don't take your supplement with a glass of milk. It probably won't cause you any real problems, but it means that you're going to waste the benefits of the calcium. So the calcium is good for your bones, and the calcium with the vitamin D is even better for your bones. So the vitamin D will actually increase the absorption of the calcium by up to 80%. So that makes a big difference. So that's why you see a lot of emphasis on the vitamin D now, and the calcium and the vitamin D. Again, we just changed our recommendations. So for the over 50s, we're looking at 800 to 2,000 international units. We used to have it at 800, then we said a minimum of 800. Now it's 800 to 2,000. The reason for that range is most people, or it's believed that most people have inefficient levels of vitamin D. There was a big rush over the last year or two for people to go and get the blood test to check the vitamin D level. And now, basically, the government is putting a stop on that because it was getting to be expensive. There's the general assumption most people don't have sufficient levels. So this range allows the doctor to say to you, maybe if you need to go on 2,000 a day to bring it up to the level it needs to be at, and once you get to that, maybe around 1,000 for maintenance. So there's a bit of a range there. Most people will take around 1,000 international units a day. Okay. Does anyone know a good source of vitamin D? Sun, yeah. It's interesting, a lot of people are getting to know about that now, but there are a few things you have to bear in mind about it. So sunlight, yes, because that helps your body generate it. However, sunlight between October and April, so over the winter months in Canada, is absolutely useless to help you generate vitamin D. So you can stand outside all day if you like. You will not generate vitamin D off that sunlight. The sun's too weak. It's not going to do it. Another thing is that to actually generate the vitamin D from sunlight, and if I had somebody from the Cancer Society here, we would be looking at each other and probably glaring. And I have been stood with people from the Cancer Society at the same time. But to go out there and get the benefits from the sunlight, you have to go out without sunblock. So the Cancer Society will stand here and say, before you go outside, put your sunblock on. We say, to get the vitamin D, if you want to go that route, getting it from sunlight, you have to be in the sunlight for about 20 minutes if you've got pale skin without sunblock, about 40 minutes if you've got dark skin. Then you can put your sunblock on after that. So what I'm giving you is sort of different pieces of information. You weigh that up and see which is most appropriate for you. One other thing is that when you get to around the age around 50 plus, your skin doesn't respond as well to the sunlight, so it's harder for it to generate the vitamin D, so maybe not as reliable. And then the fourth thing out of that would be, it's hard to get vitamin D through your food. So before I was saying get your calcium through your food, and there's quite an array of foods that have calcium in them. It's a different story with the vitamin D. You can get it in egg yolks, chicken livers, margarine, some fish and fish oils. And milk is fortified with it now, but 100 international units in a glass of milk. So if you're looking for around 2,000 international units a day and you think you can get it out of your milk, you're going to have to drink a lot of milk to get to that, and it's probably not going to do you much good. So generally, it's recommended that you go to a supplement for the vitamin D. And the difference with the vitamin D is it's cheaper, it's easy to take, you can take it all in one go. So if you're taking calcium supplements, you take as few as possible, try to get as much through your food. You don't take them with other things, take the calcium by itself because it can interfere with the absorption of any other medications, and you have to spread it out over the day. Vitamin D, you can take it all in one go and you're done. Okay? Has anybody got any questions around that? So genetics, hormones, nutrition, physical activity. So we say physical activity rather than exercise because people immediately think they have to go to an exercise class, and that really puts quite a lot of people off. What we start with is saying just stay as active as you can in your normal day-to-day life. So if you can walk somewhere, walk rather than taking the bus or driving. If you can take the stairs instead of taking an elevator, do that. And just do as much as you can for yourself around the house and at work and outside to keep yourself as active and as agile and as responsive and reflexive as possible. In your physical activity for your bones, what you're looking at is weight-bearing exercise or activity, which is basically what I'm doing here. I'm standing supporting the weight of my own body. It would help really if I actually moved a bit more because this isn't going to do it by itself. So something like dancing, climbing and skating is going to be useful. Walking is also a great aerobic exercise, but it's not going to be particularly good for your bones unless you have impact. So if you do vigorous walking, to make sure you're putting some kind of stress on your bones, that's what's important. Or carry some light weights, something like that. And the other form is resistance exercise, and that's basically where you are strengthening your bones and muscles, so weights. So you can start off as simple, if you haven't been exercising or not that active, you can start off simply by dancing around the house with cans of food. That way you've got your weight bearing and your resistance. It can be that simple. If you're starting to exercise or be more physically active, make sure you talk to your doctor first to make sure everything's okay and to get some advice on what you can do, and take it really gradually. Don't sort of dive into something. First of all, you might hurt yourself or you might cause yourself some problems, and you also might not enjoy it. Again, a lot of people don't particularly like exercise, and the challenge is finding some form of exercise that you actually like. So if you can work it through your normal day-to-day activity, and then on top of that, if you can do exercise programs, be it at home or with friends or at a gym, then that really enhances everything anyway. But the main thing is to start off really being active just at home and in your day-to-day life. So calcium's good for your bones, calcium with vitamin D is better for your bones, and calcium with vitamin D and physical activity is about the best you can do for your bones. And this goes on, again, throughout your life, starting from childhood, right up to whatever age, whether you develop osteoporosis, whether you've had fractures or not, keep the calcium, the vitamin D and the physical activity going. Better coordination and balance, and this is really to help with the falls prevention, because you have the falls, you can break the bones. What we'd look at is something like if you're physically active, your reflexes are good, you're alert, you're agile. If you think about it, if you're in a situation where you're about to trip, if you're quite responsive, you can probably stop yourself from that fall or from actually falling. In the event that you do fall and you've been looking after your bones, then your bones won't break. So it's a kind of two-step thing there. You're looking at keeping your bones strong so they don't break in the event of a fall, and you're also looking at preventing yourself getting into a situation where you're likely to fall. Exercise helps with improved muscle strength and flexibility, increased endurance, improved posture, and generally overall health and just attitude and state of mind. balance and falls prevention. Postural exercises are important, particularly if you get osteoporosis, so watch the back and the shoulders, that kind of thing, and particularly if you're talking about spinal fractures. And then falls prevention. 1 in 3 seniors, 65 plus falls a year, 1 in 2 over 80 fall. A similar story again, and once you fall, you increase the risk of falls in future, and you can get into that cycle of additional fractures, etc. Assessment of osteoporosis and fracture risk. So has anyone ever been for a bone mineral density test? Yeah. So what you'll find here is that I'm changing the way the information is presented, and this was part of the changes to our clinical practice guidelines. The gold standard was you go for a bone mineral density test, you get into a certain range, it'll tell you if you're osteoporotic, osteopenic or not, you don't have osteoporosis. Now what we look at is the risk for osteoporosis, fracture and fall, because there's a link between the three of them, obviously. So we're not just going to say, have a look and see what your risk for osteoporosis is, or if you have osteoporosis. It's all three of those things because they're connected. Fractures are the main health implication of osteoporosis, and what we tend to do is look at the 10-year fracture risk for a person. Who should be assessed? Women and men over 50 to identify those at high risk. And anyone over 50 who's experienced a low trauma fracture. Also anyone under 50 who has any conditions that might affect the bone health. So prostate cancer will come into that, a lot of other conditions, anything from anorexia or anything can affect your bone health. And these are the things that basically will be looked at. So it's a range. What we used to do previously is give lists of major risk factors and minor risk factors. And in that would come a lot of things, certain medications, certain conditions, family history, etc. Now they're kind of combined into all of them, and you'll see some of them here. Prior low trauma fracture. So again, once you've had one fracture, you increased risk of future fractures. Parental hip fracture, so you're looking at family history there. Glucocorticoid use, particularly prednisone. That three months use of any glucocorticoids really starts to put you at risk of weakened bones. So that's one of the major culprits that we tend to find. Current smoking. So not smoking 20 years ago is not something of concern. It's current smoking that can affect your bones. High alcohol intake. And for some people, they might be happy about this because we did used to say no more than 2 alcoholic drinks a day, and now it's gone up to 3. And the contradiction there is I think generally you're sort of advised by Health Canada no more than 2 drinks a day, but for some reason we now have it at 3 and your bones are fine up to 3. Some might consider that good news. Rheumatoid arthritis. There's a very close relationship between rheumatoid arthritis and osteoporosis, and that's because the arthritis can affect your bones, and also the treatment for the arthritis can affect your bones. So quite often people who have rheumatoid arthritis will also have osteoporosis. They look at whether there's a history of falls in the past 3 months, and also reviewing gait and balance. So these are the things that your doctor would be looking at to try and assess your fracture risk and your osteoporosis risk, etc. There'll be physical examination, and it'll measure weight. Risk factors around weight would be, I think they've just changed it now, so that if you're 132 pound or less, that's a risk factor for osteoporosis. And it doesn't matter if you're 3 feet. If you're 5 feet tall or 6 feet tall, it doesn't matter. If you're 132 pound or less, that's considered a risk factor because you're considered small boned. Also, if your weight is 10% lower than it was when you were about 25, that's considered a risk factor because the assumption is there must be a reason for that, some other reason for that weight loss. And then there'll be screening for vertebral fractures. So they measure height annually. If you remember before when we were showing you the spinal fractures, indicator of spinal fractures and osteoporosis is a loss of height. And actually inside this card that I'm playing with, the calcium card, there is another card, which is a small ruler. And this is basically so that when you get you go for your medical check, your yearly check, you can record your height on that. And then when you go next time, when you get your height done, you can check and see if there's any difference. So it's really just as a kind of reminder to you and to a way of collecting your information. Other things they look at, again, to the examples that I showed for spinal fractures or looking for spinal fractures, the rib to pelvis distance, so the 3 finger breadths between the hip bone and rib cage, occiput to wall distance, so that's the back of the head when you stand against the wall, spinal x-ray if that indicates there's a spinal fracture, and also assess and fold risk by the get up and go test. Does anybody know what the get up and go test is? No. Nope. Basically, you're sitting in a chair. We're going to see, can you get up out of the chair without using your arms? So can you just stand up and be steady, just walk a small distance, turn around, come back and sit without any kind of wobbling or anything like that? So that sort of is a sort of quick way to gauge falls risk. And that's the kind of thing, a check that your doctor can do. So a lot of these are very simple, basic things, you know, the occiput to wall, checking the distance between the back of your head and the wall and your rib cage and hip bone and how easily you get up out of a chair. So in men in particular, a lot of the information is similar for men, but we focus in on some that might be really quite specific for them. So fracture risk for men, prior low trauma after the age of 40, especially compression fractures, and a vertebral compression fracture, spinal fracture. Glucocorticoid use, prednisone and cortisone, for more than 3 months. Age greater than 65, one of the interesting things that we've tended to find is, apart from the fact that a lot of people don't think men have osteoporosis, you can almost guarantee, how many men here want to declare that they've had a bone mineral density test? One? Okay. If this was a room full of women, you can guarantee there'd be many more of them that will have had a bone mineral density test. So quite often, men don't actually get that test done. By 65, most women will have had it done at least once. With men, you can almost guarantee the bulk of them may not even be aware of it, let alone have been for the test. And that's what's measuring your bone density. A lot of doctors don't send men for it. But what we say is, by the age of 65, you remember before I said that your bones are basically getting weaker as you get older anyway. By the age of 65, if you haven't had a bone mineral density test, you should get one just to see what condition your bones are in, to get a kind of baseline. And that would be a message that's more significant for men, because most of them will not have been for a bone mineral density test by that stage. Excess alcohol. So here I've put in consistently more than 2 drinks a day, and on the previous one it was 3, so this one hasn't been up. So you can go with the 3 if you prefer. Primary or secondary hypogonadism, which is low levels of male hormones, and this would be information that's particularly applicable to this group. So again, you can look at the secondary osteoporosis fact sheet, but obviously there's risk factors involved, or there's risk factor involved in the kind of treatment they get for prostate cancer, as there is with other cancers too. Smoking, again, current smoking, family history of osteoporotic fracture, and low body mass index. So basically, if you're quite small boned and thin. So they're sort of recognizable as risk factors, but these are the ones that are particularly applicable to men. And this is the bone mineral density test. It's a simple test. It takes about 20 minutes, non-invasive. You just wear comfortable clothing. And what happens is that sort of arm thing above the person there sort of goes up very slowly, sort of higher up the back, and it's going to take pictures of the spine and the hip, and that's what it's measuring. Usually you get a bone mineral density test, they'll measure the density of your bones in the spine and the hip. Pictures come up on the screen there. A radiologist will read the report and translate it and send the information to your family doctor with the results. The result is usually a T-score, and what that is comparing your bones to the bones of an average 20-year-old to see how good they are. If you're anywhere between a plus number, if your results come in as a plus number anywhere down to -1, then your bones are fine. If you're between -1 down to -2.5, that's osteopenia. And anything below -2.5 is osteoporosis. So that's the T-score. And that's how they basically diagnose osteoporosis. It's a physician-ordered test. It's covered by OHIP. If you're at high risk, you can get that test once a year. So quite often what the doctor will do is send you for it, if you're diagnosed with osteoporosis, put you on medication, and then send you for a few years running to see if the medication's working. So you can do that once a year, and that's fine. If you're at low risk, you can go for your test, and then you can go again maybe 3 years later, and then it's every 5 years after that. That's the OHIP coverage. You could try to get it more often if you wanted to, but you would be paying for it. Oh, it's considered that the 1, 3, and 5 years is fine if you're at low risk. One of the things that the features of bone mineral density is that you should always go to the same machine. And I don't know if any of you remember, if any of you, those of you who've had bone mineral density tests, remember whether or not you've been to the same machine more than once. But I think most people don't remember that. Some people, or most people, might remember the site that they went to or the clinic, but the actual machine would be a different story if they've got different machines. And the reason for that is they're calibrated differently. So you could go to one machine and it'll say your bones are fine. You could go to another machine and it'll say you've got osteoporosis or you've got osteopenia, which is low bone mass. So if you go to the same one, it will indicate, you know, if you go to that one year and it says this is what your bones are like and the next year they're like this, at least you know it's working on the same basis. Whereas if you go to different machines, it's a different issue. Yes? They probably won't, unless they've only got one machine. So what we're doing to counter this, and it is getting better, we're working with the Ontario Association of Radiologists to standardise everything really across the province between clinics and within clinics so that you don't have to worry about which machine you go to or which clinic you go to. So there's a lot of standardisation and a lot of guidelines going on and training to make it much more consistent. So we do have them coming up for accreditation groups at a time for different clinics. So that is going to be improving. It already is improving. But that's one of the things just to be aware of. But, you know, it's the same thing. You know, sometimes we have people in fracture clinics around the province, and when they talk to people, these are screening coordinators, when they talk to someone who's come in with a low trauma fracture and say, have you had a bone mineral density test? Quite often the people don't even know if they've had one, or they can't remember when they had one or where. So how easy it is to remember exactly which machine is a really big challenge. So we just sort of say that to make people aware that it can be inconsistency, but it is getting better, and we're hoping basically that standardisation will come through.
So here in Brampton,
I don't know. I'd like to think they had new machines. I don't know. I could check that for you, though, because I'm going to be working with them. Actually, I'm going to be working with them very soon. You'd be pleased to know. I'll say, I'm not wishing anybody to break a bone, but in the fracture clinic at the Brampton Civic, we do have a screening coordinator. And what she does is if you go in with a low trauma fracture and you're 50 and over, she's only there 3 days a week at the moment, she will basically identify you and basically sit down and talk to you about bone health and osteoporosis. She will send a letter to advise you to go to your doctor to talk about this. She will send a letter to your doctor to say that you've been in and what she talked to you about, and ask your doctor to follow up with you to see if you need any other treatment or any kind of help or assistance. So that's actually happening at the Brampton Civic. We started that earlier this year. It works well in that clinic, and we're open to connect it with the bone mineral density people. So they will have the training, and as we bring things tighter and more closely together, it should create a more efficient system to helping people manage their osteoporosis. Who should have a bone mineral density test? All women and men 65 years and older. Postmenopausal women and men 50 to 64 with risk factors for fracture. So any of those things I listed before, family history, medications, conditions, etc. And again, anyone under the age of 50 who has a disease or condition that can affect their bone health. So, if you get osteoporosis, you're not going to get rid of it. You have to live with it. In certain cases, people are able to reverse it to a certain extent. That's usually in younger people, or if it's related specifically to a certain condition, and if they can remedy that condition and then help to reverse the osteoporosis as far as possible. They won't get it right back to the previous level, but they might be able to reverse it. But generally speaking, you've got osteoporosis, you've got to basically manage it, and what you want to do is take your calcium, vitamin D, physical activity, and if you're given medication or told to take medication, then take the medication. Now, the challenge with the medication is a lot of people don't like taking them because they're awkward, or the main ones that are awkward. I'll give you a bit of information about some of the medications in a second. Basically, they can be quite big tablets. You have to take them in the morning when you get out of bed. You can't eat or drink anything else. You can just have one big glass of water to help swallow the tablet. You have to stay upright for 30 to 60 minutes at least. So you can't get up out of bed, think, I'll take me bisphosphonate and then I'm going back to bed. You have to stay upright, and you can't eat or drink anything else for an hour or so after that. You know, so some people find this awkward. And just before, as I said before, that you can't actually feel osteoporosis developing. You don't actually feel better with taking the medications for osteoporosis. So you're not going to suddenly feel like you've got strong bones or you feel really healthy or anything like that. What you will find when you go for your next bone mineral density test, hopefully, is that your bones have not got any weaker, because that's what most of the medications are trying to do, is prevent your bones from getting weaker. And again, that can be a bit of a discouragement for some people. They don't feel better. It's awkward taking the medications. And when you go for the bone mineral density test, the bones aren't any better. The point is, your bones are not worse. And they're not going to, you know, they're not going to stay at that level unless you're taking the medication. So the aim is to basically take your medication, maintain your, or slightly increase your bone density sometimes, and reduce your risk of fracture. Yep. Here you go. Okay, so the most common ones, you'll notice most of them are on this side under the slow bone erosion. So they're not bone builders. This one's a bone builder. I'll give you some information about that in a minute. But again, the aim is to actually prevent your bones from getting weaker, and they do that by slowing the bone erosion. The most common ones are the bisphosphonates, and you might recognize some of the brand names, Fosamax and Fosavance. Fosavance is Fosamax with vitamin D included, and Actonel. They're the most commonly used ones. They're the ones with the best coverage in terms of cost as well. And they're the tablets that I was just talking about. You can get Fosamax, I think you can still get daily and weekly. Actonel, you can get weekly and monthly. I think that's just those two forms at the moment. But the options are getting broader, which a lot of people are happy about, because the other thing is they can cause gastrointestinal problems as well. So, you know, people are not always happy about taking those medications. However, they do generally prevent your bones getting worse. The zoledronic acid. The brand name's Aclasta. That was brought out 2 years ago for the treatment of osteoporosis, and it was, or approved 2 years ago for treatment for osteoporosis. And that is a once yearly infusion. It takes about 15 or 20 minutes, which is a big difference between that and a daily medication or a weekly medication. Side effects are usually flu-like symptoms for a few days. So that's another option for people, and obviously one that quite a lot of people got interested in. There's a brand new one that's just come out, the RLI, that's a rank ligand inhibitor, not a bisphosphonate, but a rank ligand inhibitor, which means it's the only one in that particular group. It's called denosumab, and the brand name is Prolia. That was approved in August of this year, and that is an injection twice yearly. So again, you can see that there's quite a variation coming up here in the forms of medications and options that are available to people. That apparently is covered by a lot of healthcare plans, but not by your OHIP or by the province. Aclasta is covered under special circumstances, so it has restricted coverage. The other two have been available, the CERN's selective estrogen receptor modulator, brand name Avista, and calcitonin, myocalcin. So they're going to slow bone erosion. As I say, the most common ones are the bisphosphonates, Fosamax and Actonel, and the generics of those particular ones as well now, because they've both gone generic. The bone builder is parathyroid hormone, or teriparatide, or Forteo is the brand name. That is for people with severe osteoporosis, which means they have osteoporosis, they've fractured, and they can't tolerate or benefit from the other medications. Now, the real downside to this one, apart from the fact that I've got it as 18 months, it's a daily injection for up to 2 years now. It's been approved for up to 2 years. It doesn't have any coverage. I think I heard recently that in some part of the country there's some limited coverage for it. It doesn't in Ontario, to my knowledge. You take it, a daily injection for 2 years. It costs $800 a month. So you're looking at something pretty expensive there. And then once you've taken that will build up your bone. But once you've taken that for the 24 months, you have to come off it because of other risks. And then you go on to a bisphosphonate to help maintain the bones at that level. So for men, not all those medications are available for men. Alendronate and resedronate, so that's basically Fosamax and Actonel, are the recommended bisphosphonates for the treatment of osteoporosis in men. Testosterone therapy improves bone mineral density and may be beneficial for men with low levels of male hormones. There's something about that information, I'm going to check that middle one because I'm sure I've come across something recently that might question that. It's still there in the slide deck, but I'm going to check that, and if there's any differences, I'll let you know. But there's something that just rang a bell when I was looking at this earlier that made me think there might have been a change in that. Parathyroid hormone has also been shown to improve BMD, or bone mineral density, in men. The new medications, I believe, are not recommended for men because they haven't really done the trials on men yet, but it may, you know, that may be an option in the future. So, that's really pretty much the information on osteoporosis. A quick bit of information on Osteoporosis Canada. We're a health charity, a non-profit. We basically provide information, education and support to the general public, and we work with health professionals around osteoporosis, providing them with education and tools that they need to work with people who are at risk of osteoporosis or who have osteoporosis. The fact sheets I've got here are examples of some of the material that we have. You can actually phone up there and ask them to send material. They'll send a package out to you. Or you can give me a call or get in touch with me and I can get the material for you. We also have a 1-800 line, which is a support line that you can call there for the information or any other information. Or you can just call to talk to some of the people. We have people who have been trained on, basically gone through training about osteoporosis and can answer questions. And also a number of them actually have osteoporosis. And it makes a big difference having somebody talking to somebody with the disease. Sometimes when I'm doing presentations, there's a particular volunteer I take out with me, and she has osteoporosis. And she has a very big impact on the audiences because she talks about how it's affected her life. It's a different thing for me to stand here and say, so it's this, 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 and this, and this is how it happened, and blah, blah, blah. But if you have someone who's actually describing it and the impact on their lifestyle, that sort of really rounds it out. So the people on the 1-800 line can be quite useful in that respect. You probably can't see it very well, but we have a website, which is osteoporosis.ca. Numerous publications and DVDs. Again, these are some of the examples. Canadian Osteoporosis Patient Network, and we have a brochure there, and that's a virtual group. So it means that it's mostly people with osteoporosis, and they sort of do things and activities, but you don't actually have to go out to meetings. So they might do online education. So we do webinars, and we've got one coming up in a couple of weeks, and you can register for that, and you can go in on the, I think it's November the 17th. You're given your password, you go online. You click into the webinar, and there's going to be a couple of dietitians talking about nutrition. And if you have questions, you can submit your questions online to them live, and they will try to respond to those questions. If you want any more information about that, I can let you know. We do some public broadcasts of that as well, but the idea, as much as anything, is to give people the opportunity to access any health practitioners around certain aspects of osteoporosis. We have chapters and support groups. We don't have a Brampton support group or chapter, but we do have a Mississauga one that sometimes comes up here. Otherwise, it's basically me that has to do a lot of the information, the support, the health events, etc. What else? Newsletters were changing at the moment, and clinical practice guidelines, which is basically what all the information I've been giving you is based upon. We have a scientific advisory council of around 60 specialists across the country, and they basically assess a lot of the information and research coming through, as well as working in research, and they advise us on the information that we can give out. And I'm just wondering if anybody knows what's going on here. Yep, Tai Chi. It's Tai Chi, skeletons. So Tai Chi is great for balance and coordination, for strength and flexibility. Not great if you've got osteoporosis, so we wouldn't suggest you suddenly get up and start doing Tai Chi. You can do it under advice from a physio who might be able to adapt the moves, mainly because if you have osteoporosis, you have to be careful about twisting and bending. It's easy to crack ribs and, you know, get spinal fractures and things. But this is really good for balance and coordination. And it's quite a mesmerizing slide as well, so that's why I put that one in there. So feel free to take any information from here. There's also some pens which have our website and phone number on that you can take. That's quite a good sort of reference. And the cards like this are also pretty useful in the Canadian Osteoporosis Patient Network brochure. And that's the end of my presentation. If you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Okay. So you can feel free to grab some refreshments. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back for questions and answers.
Have our question and answer time. My name is Paul Henshaw. I put a sheet on your tables there. It's a donation form for Movember if you're so motivated. There's a couple of posters over here. Morris and myself and several other people are growing mustaches in November called Movember. It was an organization started in Australia back in 2003. And the goal is to change the face of men's health. I love that. It's a marvelous tagline. Last year in Canada, Movember raised $7.8 million. This year, as of 5 o'clock tonight, Canada was in first place at over $6.4 million raised so far, and it's only been into a week. The activity is only a week old. Movember is a prime sponsor of Prostate Cancer Canada, and we're part of Prostate Cancer Canada Network-Brampton. So what Movember does really helps support us. And when we went to the Royal York several weeks ago for a major conference, Movember picked up the tab for it all, for bringing us together from across Canada to share common concerns, interests, and to hear about the latest developments. So it's a very worthwhile activity. I'm slightly follically challenged. I did a practice last month. It took me about 3 weeks before I could see it in the mirror. So I'm going to buy an eyebrow pencil tonight, and I hope that really helps with the way it's going. But we have a team. It's called Blue Knight Crusaders. Blue for the color, knights for courage and bravery, and crusaders for dedication to a cause. And that's us, and that's part of the Brampton group. So if you feel so inclined, there's also some cards over there. You can go online and do it, or you can take one of those if you feel so inclined. And if it's okay with your wife, as some people said it's not, I couldn't believe that, grow one yourself. Thank you.
Okay, so I know I had a lot of questions during the break. Is there anybody else who has any questions? I can't remember. yes?
Once we're on the pill, are we always on the pill? Or once the bone density is improved?
Yeah, there's a lot of questions around it. If your bone density is improved to the extent that you don't have osteoporosis, then that's something your doctor might say, you can come off it. But generally speaking, the medications, you just stay on them. There's been a lot of information in the press recently about atypical fractures, that kind of thing, which they think has been caused by the medications themselves. And that's caused a lot of people to say they want to come off the medications, or they should come off after 5 years. Generally, Osteoporosis Canada will say stay on the medications, because the medications won't work if you're not going to take them, basically. What you see, the reports, the recommendations that we give, as I mentioned before, go through the scientific come from the Scientific Advisory Council that reviews all the literature and research that's current on osteoporosis, and will basically provide their position statements based on that information. So really what most research studies agree on is what the information that we give out. When you see a study that says something like people, something like 1% or less than 1% of people on bisphosphonates fracture, and they think it's because of the fracture, they haven't proven it, for one thing. They think it might be it. But it's usually, it's one study or two studies, and quite often what they'll say at the end of it is, we suggest that there should be more research put into this. So what they're doing is raising a red flag. They're not saying everybody should come off the medication. They're saying there's a sign that maybe it's having an effect on a certain group of people, and it's usually a very small group of people too. So it's good to be aware of it. It's good to talk to your doctor about it and weigh up what the options are or what your concerns are. In this particular case, what you're looking at is, are you going to come off the medication because there's a very small risk of atypical fractures, and you usually have warnings that they're going to happen? Or are you going to stay on the medication and reduce your overall risk of fracture? It's a matter of weighing those things up, really. And for most people, it makes sense to stay on the medication. quite often doctors used to put people on medication holidays. So if you've been on them for 5 years or 10 years, take a break. But generally now they say just stay on the medication, because your bones are not going to be sustaining that level if you stop taking the medications. I think the issue with the osteoporosis medications is they're not really that old. Most of them, you know, the first one started out in the 90s, so there's no real long-term studies on the long-term impact. But again, they usually will say stay on the medication, don't take holidays. Yeah. I think you just keep aware of the information that's coming out. And the other thing, again, is if you see any stories like that in the press, wait a day or two and go to our website and you'll see what happens. What happens is we send the information to the Scientific Advisory Council and they review it, and then they'll put a position statement up at the website and tell you what they think of those studies. And it's usually along the lines of what I just said, that, you know, be aware of it, but be aware that they're just recommending further study, et cetera. Anybody else?
You used the term low trauma fracture?
Yeah. So low trauma fracture or fragility fracture. So low trauma fracture means, basically, it's not, you haven't broken a bone as a result of being in a car crash or a major accident. The low trauma fracture means that you've done it, as I mentioned earlier on, you know, where you might trip over and fall. A fall from standing height or below it, if you break a bone because of that, that's a low trauma fracture. So there's no real reason to have broken it. There's nothing that's actually caused an accident in many respects. It's a simple fall that's led to the fracture. So you'll hear it in sort of interchange between fragility and low trauma, but they're the same thing. Usually when people get the hip fractures, they're usually older and a bit more frail. But also, again, because what happens, it's not the actual fracture that causes the mortality, it's something that develops as a result of that. So it starts a cycle. So they might get an infection or they might get pneumonia, and then that's part of a downward spiral that can lead to death in 1 in 4 with the hip fractures. I think someone was asking before about the calcium as well, the difference between the calciums, the calcium supplements. So most people will take the calcium carbonates, and they're the ones that you would take with food. And most people take the calcium carbonates, and there'll be lots of different brands of those. There's also, as another option, there are calcium citrates. Quite often the calcium carbonates can cause constipation and other gastrointestinal upset. Some people will take magnesium to deal with the constipation. And that, by the way, you take the magnesium just for that. Sometimes people will say they're taking magnesium just because they think they need it. You get enough magnesium in your diet for your body's needs. The only reason to take additional amount when you're dealing with your bone health anyway is basically to help with that constipation caused by any of the calcium supplements. Another alternative to that is to switch to a calcium citrate, which is a lot easier on the internal system, but also it has smaller amounts of calcium in it. You have to take more tablets, and it's more expensive than the calcium carbonates. But again, you can go through that with the pharmacist and just try different ones, the different forms as well. Some people are happier to have the chews rather than the tablets and the liquid, that type of thing. So there's a range there. I'm trying to think of any other questions anybody asked, but I can't remember. Anybody got anything else? No? Okay. Thank you.